Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 27 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, the seventh of season three. This one is all about Queen Keska and the end of the nightmare period of Anarquist. Hello, everyone. Prepare yourself for some deep, deep diving into the reign of Queen Keska and the end of the nightmare years. Those were the days, my friends. I thought they'd never end. But gladly they did, thanks to Daimon Anarquist, the subject of the next episode of this podcast. It's inevitable, though, when covering the end of the nightmare years, that we look at the war that brought them to an end, and the general who led the army against the might of Anarquist. Overview. Queen Keska, no sobriquet, was the sister of Zalman, Nefen, and Enna, the children of Queen Grippina. Born in 334, she was crowned at the age of 58 on the death of her sister Enna the Inhuman in 392. We have no evidence for how her sister died, but thinking the worst never disappoints when considering these nightmare years monarchs. Keska reigned for 36 years, and if these years weren't as appalling for Anarquistians as the years under her mother, well, that shows how relative things can be. After a series of battles, Keska was deposed by Daimon the Brave in 428. He restored the lineage usurped by Keska's mother, Queen Grippina the Cruel, Daimon being a descendant of Ephraim, King Haldan I's second child. When you get down to it, most of Keska's reign was a continuation of her mother's, in that she finished many of the construction projects that she'd begun, and she continued to use slave labour. Where she was different is that she was more outward-looking than Queen Grippina. Early in her reign, she ordered her armies to roam across the continent and pillage any settlement they came across for slaves. The Anarquistian army in this period was overwhelmingly larger and more professional than any other army from any other realm, and for 25 years the death, destruction and abduction rampage that Keska unleashed was pretty much unchallenged. Eventually, though, the man who became King Daimon I welded together an unlikely coalition of forces and managed to defeat the Anarquistian army in battle after battle, thanks to his military genius, which, of course, we'll cover more fully in the next episode. Keska was personally leading the last of her army in the ultimate and decisive Battle of Tegemain Pass on the last day of the year 428, when she was killed in hand-to-hand combat with her successor, Daimon Anarquist. Early years. As soon as she was old enough, she followed the course that many junior members of the Anarquist family had, in that she took herself well away from her parent, out of Grippina's sight and hopefully out of mind. She set herself up in one of the royal estates, an impressive villa on the banks of the Parshel River, some 200 miles to the north of Anarquist. And there she indulged herself so much that the countryside for 100 miles around quickly became uninhabited. No one wanted to live close to her in case they were rounded up and used for entertainment. Naturally, domestic help was hard to find as well, but gradually Keska assembled a household and personal guard that was fanatically loyal to her, either because the individuals had had their spirits broken by Keska in any one of 100 nasty ways, or because they were of the same outlook and mind as Keska, which actually is pretty chilling. Two significant incidents mark this period of Keska's life. The first occurred when she was 18 and she undertook a secret tour of the continent, visiting all the major realms and cities incognito. As this was at the time when her mother had forbidden anyone from leaving the realm of Anarquist, Keska was risking much, but this familiarity with the outside world may have led to one of her first decisions after being crowned, to end the embargo on travel in and out of Anarchist. The second was a near-death experience when she was riding out on the edges of the estate and her horse stumbled on the nest of one of the giant flightless hookbeak birds that were not uncommon in that part of the world. Adult hookbeaks are nearly 2 metres tall, and their beak is a fearsome, sharp scythe, while their stout legs end in great talons capable of gutting a full-grown crocodile. A male hookbeak emerged from the nearby brush, and as males do the nesting duties, he sprang to the defence of the nest. Keska's horse was slashed by the bird's huge talons and threw her before galloping away. The groggy Keska was clawed on one side of her face, but she managed to draw her sword and back away, keeping the hookbeak at bay until she reached the river, where she plunged in and allowed the current to take her beyond the interest of the creature. Thereafter, once her scars healed, Keska always wore a half mask in either silver or gold, embedded with the finest magical scales. Reign highlights. Keska ascended to the throne in 392, and we have no indication that the transition was a problematic one. She was the last of her siblings, and as Queen Grippina's succession plan went, no questions were asked. Keska's cylinder in the Library of Souls is one of those least consulted by monarchs of Anarchist, much the same as for the other Nightmare Years monarchs. Her entry in the annals is the usual self-serving stuff, where it notes her firm leadership, her intolerance of those who would do harm to Anarchist, and a belief that the people of Anarchist are truly the dead god's heirs. Standard stuff, really, when you get to write or dictate your own encomium. As detailed in episode 6 of this podcast, the matter of the demon temple came to a head in 414 during the reign of Queen Keska, albeit far away and mostly unnoticed by her. Still, an important event in time, and one with potentially far-reaching consequences that were only discovered much, much later. As noted above, Keska's reign was in many ways a continuation of her mother's reign and her siblings' reigns of terror, but with a more expansionist bent. Within a year of ascending to the throne, Keska had thrown open the borders and encouraged trade. The first, perhaps the most greedy merchants, benefited, but soon towns and states closest the borders came to understand that the opening of borders meant, to the Anarchistians, the start of years of army incursions into other lands in search of slaves. Within a short time, Anarchist was formally at war with every state, realm, kingdom and town across the continent. If Keska had have been the laughing type, she would have laughed at this, because before launching this program of military terror, she'd made sure that the Anarchist army was extremely well-equipped, well-commanded, and with good numbers, since Anarchistians were given the choice between serving in the army or being worked to death on building projects. It's estimated that eventually a staggering 40% of the adult population was in the army. The army's initial job was to find people to enslave. Pretty simple, pretty dreadful, but it was only a start. Soon, Keska turned her mind to conquest, and soon Gesh was under attack. Gesh was a small realm, not far from the northern border of Anarchist. It was famous for its weapon makers, who, in particular, produced edged weapons of unsurpassed quality. But the weapon makers had left Gesh sometime in the reign of Keska's sister, Queen Enna, after coming into violent disagreement with their brother, King Eefan. The Anarchistian army swept into Gesh unannounced in a shocking, overwhelming show of force. After the conquest of Gesh, Perrin came under attack, and soon the slightly more distant realms of Borte, Arenthia, and both Inner and Outer Honf were subject to incursions from the rampaging Anarchistian army. One thing to note, though, even Keska thought that invading Jalox would be a bad idea, and it was left alone. Distance and the forbidding desert had generally cut off the western side of the continent from the east, but Keska's military build-up had included extending the navy, so fleets were soon crossing the great southern gulf that vast open bay that forms much of the barrier between east and west of the continent on the side of the sea. These fleets had been given license to raid Resmia, Toltres and Ulm on the southwestern coast, and they went to it with a will. At this, even the far northerly realms, such as Kildare and Benthia, began to take stock, and then panic, after the Anaquistian navy staged a raid on the realm of Brel in the far north. Accounts vary as to how many people from other realms were taken as slaves and dragged into a life of servitude, labour, and, most often, early death, but a figure that is generally agreed upon is somewhere around 200,000. Very few of these people ever made it back to their homelands, but those who did spoke of being worked to death, as the fate of most. Anaquist had gone from being an isolated, metaphorically walled kingdom in the nightmare years to being a belligerent military state under Queen Kesca. The ease with which the Anaquistian army struck other lands and then withdrew suggested that a conquest of the entire continent wasn't out of the question. This, of course, has been much debated. Inez Stilchin, who wrote the authoritative book The Early Aristocratic Families of Anaquist, a book I used for much of the background to episode 4 in season 1 of this podcast, has recently completed another compelling and weighty book called The Nightmare Years, which looks at the reign of all the Anaquistian monarchs from Queen Grippina to Queen Kesca, and she's assembled a great deal of primary evidence that hasn't been widely known up until this point. She states categorically that Kesca came to the desire to conquer the continent gradually. Once she'd unleashed the army and saw the way it was virtually unchallenged by realm after realm, she saw the next step of conquering the entire world below the war in the heavens as both possible and entirely logical. The strongest proponent of the opposite point of view was Jabez Soames, the 19th century highly eccentric scholar who I also drew on in season 1, episode 4. He staunchly defends Kesca in every way, claiming she wasn't like any of her immediate forebears, and she was mostly interested in ducks, geese, and other waterfowl. He did go on to suggest that she bore children by laying eggs, so his view surely can be discounted. Regardless of how long Kesca held this ambition, by 395 it was clear that Anaquist was on the march. Gesh was conquered and annexed by autumn 395, and Bortav was under siege within months. If her reign had been less oppressive, if she'd treated her people more kindly, Kesca might have been known as the Warrior Queen or something similar, because soon after it became clear that Anaquist was embarking upon a campaign of conquest, she personally began to lead the troops on the battlefield. Up until this point in time, it wasn't unknown for Anaquistian monarchs to lead their armies in person, but Queen Kesca's ferocity, enthusiasm, and wild joy in battle sets her apart. From the earliest skirmishes with Gesh, Kesca was in the front line, either in one of the greatly feared Anaquistian massed cavalry charges or leading her foot soldiers. She was an unmistakable figure. She wore the best hooped armour on the continent, and the metal was covered with scales of the finest quality, making it almost impervious to any ordinary strike. The scales were uniformly jet in colour, and her tall black figure, advancing at the head of thousands of well-trained troops with a sword made of heavenly metal, was enough to inspire a rout, even before the opposing forces clashed. She soon gained a reputation not just for bravery, but for savagery. She would never grant mercy, and it was said that she sang when she decapitated any foe who fell to their knees and begged for compassion. With Queen Kesca leading from the front, the Anaquistian army was unstoppable. Thousands of prisoners were taken and dragged back to Anaquist as slaves. Kesca dealt death in the thick of battle, flanked but never preceded by her personal guard, fierce warriors all. Soon after the fall of Gesh, tales of her bloodthirstiness spread across the continent. Not content to slay her foes, she was said to mutilate the fallen with wild glee. Her strategic plans were hard to divine, however. Instead of rolling from Gesh to neighbouring Bortav, the obvious next target, Kesca confounded expectations and divided her army. Half stayed in Gesh to subjugate it utterly, crushing any remnants of resistance and channeling the remaining population southwards into slavery. The other half embarked onto the Anacrustean fleet that had sailed up the east coast and proceeded to skip Bortov and invade Anacrus' long-time trading rival Arrhenthia in late 396. This was no incursion or raid, as previous attacks on Arrhenthia had been. This was a slaughter. Very few Arrhenthians survived to be enslaved, and the entire capital, Arrhenth, was set on fire and razed. The Anacrustean army spread out from the port and systematically pillaged, then burned, all towns and settlements belonging to Arrhenthia until none was left. Triumph or misstep? Show of overwhelming force or one step too far? Queen Kesca's motivation may have been more economic than military, according to Earl Fisden, who, as a military historian, when he sees other reasons for military action, it's worth taking note. He suspects that Arrhenthia's long-term economic rivalry with Anacrust had been a long-time source of resentment. A series of slights, rebuffs and differences accumulating in the minds of the ruling dynasty until a particularly warlike monarch decided that enough was enough. Fisden's case is a convincing one. Regardless of her motivations and ambitions, the Arrhenthian bloodbath of 396 terrified most of the other realms in the world below the war in the heavens. What should they do? What could they do? It was clear that survival, in a very real sense, was at stake. I'll cover the events and personalities of the Lashmine Conference of early 397 in the next episode. It's enough to say that an alliance of most of the major and minor realms across the continent was formed after this alarmed get-together, and that a united alliance army resulted, commanded by a man who many considered the rightful king of Anacrust. If you remember episode 10 of season 2, the Anacrustean crown had been usurped by Agrippina the Cruel in the year 339, Kesca's mother. If you remember episode 10 of season 2, the Anacrustean crown had been usurped by Agrippina the Cruel, Queen Kesca's mother, in the year 339, when King Haldan I disappeared in circumstances that were more than suspicious. All of King Haldan's children, Soltima, Ephraim and Abelard, were presumed to have been murdered by Queen Agrippina on her way to seizing the throne. But as it transpires, this wasn't the case. Ephraim, Haldan's second child, managed to escape and made his way to the far northern realm of Brill. In exile, he made a fortune, married, and had children. Daimon was the oldest, and he rose to command Brill's army, and he proved himself to be an outstanding leader, strategist, and tactician. More about him in the next episode. Back to Queen Kesca's war plans. Between Kildare and Arrhenthia lay the odd realms of Honf and Inner Honf. Were they part of the same realm? Were they separate? Who knows? And probably the Honfians didn't, as over these early centuries, these two lands, one on the coast and the other on the other side of the massive transcontinental mountain range, well, they've united and split, united and split again and again. At this time, in the late 4th century, they were determinedly separate and had sent separate delegates to the Lashmine Conference, as well as contributing separate forces to the Alliance Army. When Queen Kesca looked north from Arrhenthia, Inner Honf wasn't far away, and it was a tempting target with rich iron and copper mines, while Honf, lying on the coast, it would be an excellent berthing place for the navy prior to launching attacks further north on Kildare and Framan. Honfians, whether inner or not, saw themselves fairly and squarely as the next target for Queen Kesca. Thousands fled, heading north towards Kildare, and this may have made Kesca move her forces before they were ready. Rest and resupply would have been important after the destruction in laying waste to Arrhenthia, and Kesca's direction to take both Honfs may have been premature. The Anacrustean commanders hadn't risen to the position they had by disagreeing with Queen Kesca, though. The forces were readied and ordered to march north, following the primitive road that was in place at the time, while the navy sailed along the coast. Looking at the terrain in the present, it can be hard to imagine what it was like back in this late 4th century. The coastal countryside was lush with giant ironwood trees and thick scrub. The road is long, with many a winding turn. Tumbling rivers roared down from the mountain and head for the coast, each one of which posed a challenging crossing. Regardless of the difficulties, and perhaps overconfident after the success of her campaign thus far, Queen Kesca led from the front and advanced toward Homp. Attrition occurred. But Kesca lashed her commanders and her troops, never flinching when faced by these natural obstacles. Was it fear or admiration that drove her soldiers on? Most likely a combination of both, plus the prospect of more loot. After the sack of Arrhenthia, even the lowliest foot soldier found enough to guarantee a comfortable life when their service ended, if they survived, that was. Reaching the somewhat indeterminate border of Honf with not inconsiderable losses due to the difficult march, Kesca allowed her troops free rein in pillaging the eerily abandoned border towns they encountered, and then she made a fateful decision. Instead of marching straight for Chilling, the port capital of Honf, she decided to take her forces west to Inner Honf and subjugate it first before crushing coastal Honf. This was one of those tipping points of history. Who knows what would have happened if Kesca hadn't gone this way? Would the Anaquistian army and navy have rolled over the coastal realms one by one, crushing them all before moving inland? Would the world below the war in the heavens today simply be called Greater Anaquist? Some suggest that the Alliance army had agents in Queen Kesca's camp, trusted enough to suggest that tackling Inner Honf would be the best way to proceed. Others point to rumours of recent immense heaven falls in the desert to the west of Inner Honf. Regardless, Queen Kesca marched her army across southern Honf to the main route through the mountains, the now fabled Tegemain Pass. The Battle of Tegemain Pass is legendary. Stories of unbelievable bravery have been told right across the continent for centuries, and it's rightly seen as a turning point in the history of the world below the war in the heavens. Even in the present, a ceremony is held every mid-year day to commemorate the courageous souls who fought in the narrow confines of what could more accurately be called a defile than a pass, so narrow is it, so steep are its sides. The Tegemain Pass had long been the main route between Honf and Inner Honf, and despite its 12 miles of narrow twistiness, it was well used for trade and general communication between the two related realms. After the rout of Arrhenthia, Kesca and her commanders weren't looking for any resistance as they poured their troops into it, but they hadn't reckoned on the cunning of Daimon Anaquist, the supreme commander of the Allied army. When news came to the Allied army that Kesca had committed to attacking Inner Honf, Daimon had moved quickly to seize the high ground on either side of the pass, where they battered the Anaquistian army with rocks and missiles until it reached the exit of the pass, when the Allied troops brought down an avalanche that blocked the pass entirely. The Anaquistians had to turn around. Easier said than done. Despite the slaughter, Kesca led the army from the head, protected by her magical armour from arrows and sling bullets, but still vulnerable to the rocks being hurled from above. She rallied her troops, however, preventing outright panic and making sure that the marching at the double was exactly that. In the retreat, at least a third of Kesca's army perished, but it was still a formidable fighting force when it drew within sight of the eastern end of the pass and freedom from the death from the heights. That was when Daimon Anaquist brought the rest of his allied army into formation to block the pass at that end. In the narrowness, numbers weren't as important as they would have been in the open field. 30,000 Anaquistians faced 10,000 of the allied army, but while the allies held the cork in the bottle, boulders and missiles continued to fall from the heights to slaughter the Anaquistians. In the thick of the fray, as was her wont, after hours of horror, Kesca, clad in her magical armour and with a scale-inlaid sword, had almost carved a way through the doughty allied line. Her personal guard cut a swathe at her side, and the matter was in balance when Daimon Anaquist stepped up, flanked by his two sons, Blemon and Hotch. Kesca was said to have laughed when she saw Daimon, recognising him and crying, Death awaits, cousin. And so it did. Despite her disfigurement, Casca was known to be vain, to the extent she only wore a light helm in battle, allowing her long blonde hair to fall free. Daimon saw that this helm had come askew in the retreat through the pass, and after an engagement that would have left many dead within minutes, but between these two lasted nearly an hour, Daimon twisted from a clinch, saw his chance, and slashed the side of Keska's neck. She fell and was dead in seconds. The Anaquistian army fought on, but surrendered quickly after news came that their navy had been routed by Daimon's naval tactics, when a fleet of small and nimble boats had ambushed it as it rounded Cape Rosamuch on its way up the coast. These boats, many commandeered from local fisherfolk, darted in and among the Anaquistian fleet, hurling pots of a flaming, sticky, pitch-like substance that clung to the sides of the huge warships and set many on fire. The fleet withdrew in disarray, and Queen Keska's defeat was complete. Personal life. Keska had two children by two unknown fathers. Enna was born in 402 and Yefin in 404, both named after nightmare year's forebears. Enna died with her mother in the Battle of Tegemain Pass, while Yefin left the capital as a youth and ended up in the Demon Temple, where he disappeared like all those who were there in the year 414. Keska was a formidable warrior, perhaps turning the family penchant for blood and cruelty to what some say is a more worthwhile pursuit, becoming an alarmingly competent military leader. Last words. Queen Keska, the last monarch of the legendary Anaquistian nightmare years. Leader, warrior, very nearly the conqueror of the entire continent. And that's it for episode 27 of The World Below the War in the Heavens podcast. Coming up next, King Daimon the First and the Restoration. Until then, farewell and may the heavens smile upon you.
This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell.